Full Service Radio.
Welcome to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio. We're broadcasting live from the Line Hotel in DC, and I'm your host, Kiko Bourne. You've tuned into the sixth episode in our Teaching Food series. So far, we've talked about teaching food in school, teaching food for people on a tight budget, teaching food jobs, the theory of behavior change in teaching food, and teaching food in the doctor's office. Today's interview will be fun because it gets us out of the classroom, out of the kitchen even, out into the garden and out to the farm. Everyone eats food, and these days everyone shops for food, but most people go through life without learning how to grow food. So I'm really excited to be talking today with three food growing teachers, Shauna DeWitt, Attila Augustin, did I say it right?
You got it.
Okay. Shauna DeWitt and Attila Augustin, who teach seasonal workers, their kids, and the public how to grow food on their Mountain View farm in Nearsville, Virginia. And Dana Bourne, who, yes, you heard the name right. I got my sister to be willing enough to be a guest on Lunch Agenda. Dana, who teaches the New York City community how to grow food. We're going to talk about what techniques they think are most important for rural and urban food growers to know, and we'll hear their recommendations for each of us to seek out farm learning opportunities wherever we live and given however much time we have. But before our interview starts, here's a little Kiko's food news to get you up to speed on the week in the food system. Okay, first headline of the week. While McDonald's, the nation's largest restaurant chain, has committed to using cage-free eggs by 2025 and gestation crate-free pork by 2022, they have yet to make a similar commitment for their chickens. But public demand for that commitment has increased. Earlier this month, celebrities like Kristen Bell, Joan Jett, and Weird Al Yankovic demanded more humane treatment, and maybe even more impactfully, or definitely more impactfully, the third largest public pension fund in the U.S. and holder of more than $300 million in McDonald's stock issued a warning addressed to McDonald's chairman and CEO. It urged the restaurant giant to follow competitors such as Burger King and Subway in making, quote, modest reforms to its chicken welfare policies, including transitioning to more humane breeds and slaughter practices. Second headline, speaking of commitments by huge chains to source more humanely, only 27% of 100 big food restaurant and hospitality companies that promised to switch to cage-free eggs say they're any closer to that goal. The large majority declined to say whether they've made any progress. Cereal giant Kellogg had made a commitment, but admitted that less than 1% of the eggs it uses are cage-free. Meanwhile, Mars, Inc. and the Hilton Hotel chain both elected, quote, do not report when surveyed by third-party auditor Compassion and World Farming. I'm realizing that I'm reading this headline in the company of egg farmers, chicken farmers, egg farmers from whom I get my eggs, and it's just pretty ironic. Finally, third headline of the day. A legal complaint was filed against LaCroix's parent company, alleging that thousands of consumers purchased LaCroix under the mistaken belief that it conforms with its packaging and advertising claims to be all natural or 100% natural. It claims that one of the ingredients is used as a cockroach insecticide, but LaCroix continues to claim its flavoring comes from natural essence oils derived from fruit. To me, this just underscores the laziness of the term natural on any packaging. It comes with no criteria, and clearly it leads people to unfair assumptions based on lack of other information. Last headline of the week. Details came out this week about how long we still have to go in school food. In response to the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act that President Obama signed into law in 2010, food companies rushed to reformulate their products to meet the smart snack standards required to be a school food vendor. So Frito-Lay debuted a smart snack version of its Flamin' Hot Cheetos that had less fat and salt and more whole grains. Domino's created the Smart Slice, which is a pizza made with a third less salt, reduced fat cheese, and 51% ultra grain white whole wheat flour. So while these foods technically meet the federal nutrition standards, experts agree they're nowhere near healthy. Plus, advocates say getting kids hooked on big processed food brands is an even bigger issue than the quantity of salt and sugar in these particular foods. As Marion Nessel, who I interviewed last month as we kicked off our teaching food series on Lunch Agenda, said, it encourages kids to eat fast food and it points out the absurdity of school nutrition standards, which can be so easily gamed, end quote. On a brighter note, I just want to make a plug, as I sometimes do for events that food learners, like a lot of my listeners, might be interested in. So if you're in DC the weekend of November 1st through 3rd, consider checking out the 4th annual Smithsonian Food History Weekend at the National Museum of American History. The weekend includes roundtables with food historians like Michael Twitty, a festival with kids activities, a whole grains learning area that will feature a former Lunch Agenda guest, Jason White of UMD's Plant Science Department, and more. That's November 1st through 3rd, and you can learn more at americanhistory.si.edu. So we're going to take a quick break after that big dose of food news, and when we come back, I'm excited to introduce Shauna and Attila and Dana so that they can tell us all about growing food and how they teach it. Stay tuned. This episode of Lunch Agenda is sponsored by Brian Smith of Compass Real Estate. Brian helped me buy my house 5 years ago and wanted to support Lunch Agenda just like he supports so many of Washington's greatest causes. I encourage you to check him out at compass.com if you're ready to look at houses in DC. He is the best, and I'm happy to tell you all about him. Welcome back to Lunch Agenda on Full Service Radio at the Line Hotel in DC. I'm your host, Kiko Bourne, and you've tuned into our fall teaching food series. Today we're learning about teaching food growing. How do city folks learn to grow in their urban garden plot or in pots at home? How do people learn to grow food in huge quantities at production farms with all the machinery, strategic planning, and environmental knowledge that farming requires? So let me introduce our food growing educators and then we'll start to dig in. No pun intended. Shauna DeWitt and Attila, How do I say it best?
Augustin.
And Attila Augustin operate Mountain View Farm in Nearsville, Virginia, approximately 65 miles west of where we are in Washington, D.C. They lease their farmland from the Blue Ridge Center for Environmental Stewardship, a 900-acre nature preserve footsteps away from the Appalachian Trail. Mountain View Farm is a USDA-certified organic vegetable operation that sells at 3 seasonal farmers markets and an assortment of restaurants in Washington, D.C., I should add, including the restaurant right here in the Line Hotel, Rake's Progress. This is Attila and Shauna's 11th season at Mountain View Farm, and the farm is also home to their 2 children, Ruby and Emmett, 10 and 8, and a rotating cast of young seasonal farm workers. Fun fact, in addition to working on the farm, Shauna is a certified professional midwife and is part of a home birth practice with 4 other midwives called Riverside Midwifery. Welcome, Shauna and Attila.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great to have you, and thanks for driving all this way to be on the show. Dana Bourne is a farmer and environmental educator based in Brooklyn, New York, currently managing a 1-acre urban farm on New York City's Governor's Island. Dana started farming as a crew member at Hardy Roots Farm in the Hudson Valley, and more recently worked as an environmental educator for several years at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, and she's now at Grow NYC. Dana has worked with children and adults to connect all New Yorkers to where our food comes from and the land we rely on. Welcome, Dana.
Thanks, Kiko.
So most food is grown in large farms in rural areas. So I want to start with the perspective of Shauna and Attila, farmers who have taught many others how to grow and also how to sell a large, huge variety of fruits, vegetables, and eggs, as I mentioned earlier, and maybe some other products that I'm not even aware of, from Virginia to the D.C. market. So Shauna and Attila, and either of you can answer any of these questions, before starting your farming careers, I know that you two met while you were working at the South Pole for the U.S. Antarctica program, which led you to your first farm jobs as apprentices at Maple Rock Farm on Orcas Island in Washington State. Who taught you to grow food, and how did you know when you had learned enough to run your own farm? Shauna's looking at me with big eyes like, yeah, you got to know a lot.
Yeah, it's a good question. Well, we just kind of jumped in with both feet and started
an apprenticeship at Maple Rock Farm on Orcas Island. We really just had idealistic ideas of farming and wanted to get away from, like, the rat race. We worked there for 2 years, right?
Yep.
Yeah, 2 years. And then I think we foolishly thought we knew what we needed to know, and we decided to move all the way across country to a completely different climate and just try to do what we barely knew how to do after a 2-year apprenticeship. So that plan didn't exactly work out. Like, our first many years on the farm that we're on now were trial and error, and mostly error.
You said first how many years?
I don't know, 4 maybe. I mean, our first year there were markets where we made like $35. Like, we really did not know what we were doing, but those were some of our best lessons, to just kind of jump in and do it. And actually, we had a lot of amazing neighbors and farmers in our area who would share their books and their planting calendars and their many years of experience. So they were really our best teachers, but the land was our teacher first and foremost, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, we were definitely lucky to get here. Like Shauna said, there's a really strong scene of farmers in this sort of the periphery on the outskirts of D.C. And where we live in Loudoun County, we have, it's this kind of a multi-generational group of farmers that took us in and really helped point us, actually pointed us towards D.C. One of the first people we met, Ellen Polishuk at Potomac Vegetable Farms, she said early on, she's like, if you want to make it, you need to go in that direction. And she pointed towards the city, you know, where the people are. And once the first market we got into in D.C. was 14th and U, and we're still there.
And to make sure that I don't forget the opportunity, if listeners live in D.C., what are the three markets? You're at 14th and U still?
Mm-hmm. We're at 14th and U on Saturdays, Bloomingdale, which is 1st and R, on Sundays, and then Penn Quarter on Thursday
Great.
Afternoon.
Great. Yeah. Great. And how many seasonal farm workers do you take on each year that you kind of take responsibility for teaching, and how long are they with you?
So we usually hire 3 people for the whole season, which is basically March to November, and then we generally pick up another person for a few months, like in the height of tomato picking. And we find the workers in the same outlet that we actually first found our farm on, Maple Rock Farm, which is this website called attra.org, attra.org. And we also there's a newer one, Good Food Jobs, that they both have this sort of clearinghouse of farms that are hiring seasonal workers. And those two outlets are generally how we come across the crew.
And what do you look for in an intern? What's most important for someone that you're going to invest so much of your time and knowledge into?
Yeah, well, we really prefer to hire people who are serious about continuing farming, because we hope to do the same thing. Like, we open all of our records, all of our books, you know, all of our experience to people with hopes that they'll take that and go from there with their own farms. You know, we love hiring former Peace Corps volunteers, people who are used to just different experiences and really putting themselves completely in it. You know, farming, we can't guarantee anything. You're going to be working when it's really cold and really wet and really hot, and it's not all like sunny days, you know, picking carrots and what else do we look for?
When I was at your house for dinner a couple weeks ago or a month ago, you had that great community dinner. I remember you saying that you hire people who are going to blend in with the family.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that this is a family farm.
Yeah.
And that there are going to be kids around and everything else that comes with family life.
Yeah, that really comes with just launching yourself into the whole experience, because it's Attila and I, and then we have two kids, and our kids are going to want to be friends with whoever works on our farm. So there's everything. There's, you know, and when you only have three people, you're going to be part of every aspect of a farm and every aspect of a family that's on that farm.
Yeah, it's like one big family.
Yeah. He's not saying one big happy family. Happy,
mostly
it's
happy.
Usually mostly happy. Yeah. Yeah. I've seen all happy. And what's the hardest thing to teach them?
It's a good question. I guess, you know, it takes a hard work ethic, and that probably starts at an earlier age than when we're getting people. But I think really most success in farming is being observant, and for us to sort of teach that aspect, that keeping your eyes open and being able to prioritize when you see things that come up, and then what's more important to like put your time and resources towards. And a lot of that stuff you can't really learn until you actually start your own farm. So that's why it goes back to what Shauna said. We really like hiring people that have expressed interest in like doing their own thing. And that really frames the experience for us, because then we can just have this sort of ongoing conversation throughout the season of, you know, here's some mistakes. We've tried this. This didn't work. We can save you, you know, maybe we can save you that mistake in the future. So yeah, being observant, and I think that's an important part of being a good farmer.
Yeah, being flexible for sure, because things always shift, and we can't guarantee any sort of hours, or I mean, sometimes everybody has to work early because it's gonna be a downpour later or something like that. But
are there any mechanisms that you use, like, you know, you make sure that they each keep a farm journal of their own, or I don't know, that I, who's never worked on a farm, wouldn't even think of it as a way for them to kind of catalog their learning and be able to refer to it later or anything?
Well, we have an extensive library of farming books, and it is interesting. You kind of can see who's really consuming a lot of information. And we do recommend people just carry a notebook in their pocket at all times and just continue to jot down just anything that comes up. But I think one interesting thing I wish we had known when we were interns is that I think we thought by working on one farm, that was the way to do it. And then we just took that knowledge and tried to do it somewhere else. And then realize there are like a million ways to do this. So I hope we impart that to the people who work with us too. Like, here's what we do. And I just want to say, we also have this program that we're a part of called CRAFT, which is Collaborative Regional Alliance for Farmers in Training. They're all over the country, but they're regional. And so along with some other farmers, we started one in this area. So it's basically throughout the main body of the farming season, there's a tour of different farms every 3 weeks, and then a midsummer farming conference that we host at our farm. And so it's for lots of different farmers in the area and their interns or their workers. So they can see a lot of different farming systems. And then the conference is really awesome. It's just like a full day with all different breakout sessions, and really trying to like expand the knowledge of people who are trying to learn to farm. So, you know, they may see something on another farm that really clicks. That's not what we do. And we see things on farms where we're like, that's awesome.
That's so cool. It's kind of like the neighborhood open house days where like home decoration types can go pull ideas from other houses. But this time it's...
That's the city version. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So do you two feel like you have more people who want to learn than you can take on? Or is it the opposite? Do you feel there's a dearth in interested, you know, aspiring farmers in this area?
I guess that's a good question. I think we usually get maybe 40 or so inquiries each year, sometimes maybe 60, but not all of them are totally serious. But we've never been too worried about not being able to get a crew, so that's good. It still seems to be a big interest. And we actually, most of the people that we've hired are actually from, you know, not, they're not local. They kind of tap into those two websites I mentioned from all over the country. So it seems like there's still a pretty strong interest mm-hmm. in from young people to get into farming.
Mm-hmm. I would say that all three of you, Shauna, Attila, and Dana, who we'll start talking to in just a moment, you're all working to kind of reverse a national trend that's threatening our food security, which is the decline of young people entering farming, or maybe not even young people. I mean, even if you're getting pretty good demand for your spots, we all know the numbers nationally. And there was a great Wendell Berry article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago. I don't know if you two read it. My sister and I were talking about it. And for listeners who don't know Wendell Berry, he's a celebrated farmer, essayist, and poet from Kentucky. And I just want to quickly read one part of that article. He said that, quote, "There are active prejudices against farmers, country people, the country, small town people, and small towns. Because of such prejudices, and also because of economic adversity, farmers encourage their children to leave farming. What can we do about this?" End quote. Not that I'm expecting you guys to solve that problem right now, but is there anything that you think can help change the prejudice? If you think that's what's needed to attract more people to this vocation?
Mm-hmm. Probably farmers maybe talking about the money side more to show, you know, I guess shining the light on profitable farms or farms that are
great
successful
point.
in some other, you know, all different types of metrics. I guess that would help, shining the light on the farms out there that are doing good.
And I like what you say about successful in all different kinds of metrics, because I think there are a lot of reasons why we each choose the careers and the lifestyles we do. And the economic profitability is, of course, one important one. But I would think that a lot of farms, just like a lot of households, have different ways of measuring, quote, success. So it might be that it's the health of the family. It might be that it's ability to choose every day's activity, whatever it is. What, anything you would add, Shauna?
Yeah, I would say it's funny. It was a focus when we went to PASA, which is Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture, a few years ago. Their whole focus was how to make farming sexy, basically, like attractive to young people. And I don't think we actually came up with an answer at that conference, but I do think about it every time we have a group of young people on the farm. I do like to talk to them about, has anybody ever heard in high school that this was a career option? I never did. I grew up in Denver, you know, but it wasn't until later that I realized this was an option to be outside, to grow food, to be my own boss, to wear what I want, you know, and also that farming has so much to it. I mean, it's not, you have to be a real generalist, you know, so you have to know a lot about a lot of different subjects, and that's going to keep it interesting. So I like to talk to groups about that when they come, just that this isn't some weird thing we do, like this is actually something you could do too.
Right, right. Yeah. I personally am lucky enough to live a few blocks from the farmers market, one of the three you mentioned, the Bloomingdale one. And each time I see you there, you're teaching us, you're casually teaching us urban residents about farming, about food growing. You know, it's not like you're telling us every step you took to bring a certain product to market, but you're telling us about how pepper varietals taste, or you're telling me, you know, why watermelons are grown with seeds and why that's the traditional way. What do you think is the most important things, are the most important things for those of us who don't farm for a living to know about how food is grown?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
Do you want to say it, Till?
I mean, it's not always the easiest thing, but if there's a way to see, you know, get out to a farm to see, or maybe even just knowing the farmer, getting to know them as a person and having trust, you know. It's a relationship between the producer and the consumer that should be based on trust. So I'm not sure exactly how to describe that, but if there was ways to for people to come out to the farm so they could see for themselves what it looks like.
Do you think most farmers feel that way when they're at market, that they want to engage in longer conversations with the customer?
I think if they don't, then they don't come to market. They send somebody else.
Good point.
And I agree with Attila, just asking what you really want to know. If you're curious about how your food is grown, because there are a lot of different ways to grow food, I think that it's really important to get the information that you want, that's right for your family. And yeah, I think it's different for everybody. For us, the relationship is really important. Like every year at the first market, I have to like calm myself down in the truck to be like, don't get too excited when you see so-and-so, just like stay calm, stay cool. Don't make a fool of yourself. And so, we grow our food and we feed our family. So we feed other people's families the way that we want our family to eat. Hope that didn't sound too convoluted, but and so, you know, there's some people just assume that's how all their food is grown, and it's really not. So yeah, being really clear about what the standards are for your family and asking the questions to get that, and that will include those face-to-face conversations. So going to market and buying local, you're not going to have a conversation if you're going to the store with anybody who knows anything.
I really like your point about it's too easy to assume that all our food is grown in a way that we want to assume, I guess. Thanks. So speaking of we urban dwellers, let's move over to Dana for a moment. Give Shauna and Attila a breather, but I've invited them to chime in at any time. So Dana works in the heart of New York City. And Dana, you did your college senior project on the Three Sisters, beans, corns, and squash. So mm-hmm. You were clearly always interested in produce, but you learned to grow food later on. Well, soon after college. But who were your most important food growing teachers, Dana? And what skills did you learn from them that were most crucial in order to, you know, land the job at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, be in charge your own farm there, and now have a whole acre under your responsibility?
Yeah, I think my first food and sort of farming teacher was in a position where I wasn't actually doing a lot of the growing myself, but I had the opportunity to work for a family farm while I was in college. The farm was called Montgomery Place Orchard, and it was a mix of a historic fruit orchard, and also they grew vegetables and flowers. And I mostly worked at the farm market, but I think that that was a really important learning experience for me to see how Talia, who, you know, ran the farm, was sort of selling and marketing the produce and building this incredible community around this exchange that was filled with trust. And I thought that, like, that was just said, and it really struck a chord, because I don't think I had ever had a job where, when I was sort of the face of their farm, selling things, talking to customers, I just felt so thrilled to be that person and so confident that our exchange was just filled with trust and all good in every way that I could think of. So that was really important for me, and that sort of led me to my next job, which was working as a crew member at Hardy Roots Farm, which at the time was about a 25-acre vegetable farm that wasn't certified organic, now is, but growing organically, that grew mostly for CSAs and then also for some markets. And that was my first real experience of learning how to grow food. And I was just very much thrown in. I did not have the background that a lot of people had going into that job, having worked at other farms. And it was incredibly hard and fast paced. And I learned a ton. And, like, you know, if you've met Kiko, if you've met my sister, you know that we like to gesture a lot while we talk. So I would be repeatedly told that I couldn't gesture while I spoke because it meant I wasn't working fast enough. So it was definitely like a crash course into just growing food and harvesting and, you know, processing everything to get it ready to sell. So I feel like that was my biggest, for sure, my biggest learning in farming. And then when I moved to the city and started growing at the Brooklyn Botanic Garden, it was, a, you know, in certain ways, a total relearning of what it means to grow at a very small scale in an education setting, so not a production setting. So I just had sort of an experience, again, sort of relearning some things. And it's true, in every space you're in, you're going to learn how to grow things differently and, you know, work the soil differently. And so learning from my coworkers at the Botanic Garden was just then another layer of learning. So, yeah.
Awesome. And you, at the Botanic Garden, you were a teacher more than anything else, both in the garden and even in classrooms across public schools in Brooklyn. How do you, mm-hmm. how did you inspire students who live in New York City to learn food growing if they don't even have a garden at home that they can then put their skills to use in?
Yeah. Well, so first, I think as someone who didn't grow up in New York City or Brooklyn specifically, it was really important for me to see how many people were growing food at home. There's just a huge number of people who grow in community gardens, who grow in their, you know, tiny alleys next to their house and their fire escapes. And so a lot of the students and teachers and adults that I was working with had a lot to offer in terms of their own knowledge of growing food and how to do that in an urban setting that I didn't have going into the job. So that was the first thing. But I think the other thing is that just, you know, how we get our food and the fact that there is a food system is just such an abstract thing if you haven't seen it happen or really thought about it or been forced to think about it. And so I think that just having the experience of being in a garden and seeing a broccoli growing and being like, is that's it? Like, that's how it comes to the grocery store. And it's true that not every farm looks like sort of a diverse organic, you know, garden in the Botanic Garden. But in a sense, it's just like putting a visual image to how we're, like, food is even grown. And so I think that, like, getting people into a space where they're being forced to sort of observe and look at it and understand that, like, every time they're eating something every day, they're connecting with soil, whether they realized it or not before. It's just the power of being, you know, having a garden within a city. And I think also just, like, really trying to bring in, you know, the people who you're working with as individuals. So asking them, you know, if they see a food, like how they cook it or what they call it. Or when we worked with students over the summer, we'd always have them bring recipes from home in that we could cook with our food in the garden. So just making it feel relevant to them in any way we can.
Absolutely. I'm having flashbacks to the interview two episodes ago with Sasha Bernstein, Scon of the Cooking Project, about, you know, you have to make it about the student, about their traditions, mm-hmm. about what foods they like. And that's really how you get their buy-in to learn a whole new area like food growing is. How do you get people past the idea that soil is dirty and that, you know, it's something that they might have been told growing up that they should clean off their hands right away? You know, how do you get them into the notion of soil as a thing that needs to be healthy and that they want to get their hands into?
It's a good question. I find it surprisingly easy with most groups to get them to just put their hands in the soil, because especially with kids, like, it's really fun. And as soon as one kid puts their hands in, they all want to do it. But we always want to make sure that everyone feels really comfortable, because it's true, like, a lot of kids aren't supposed to get their clothes dirty and don't, you know, and have never put their hands in soil and touched a worm. So we always, like, offer gloves if people want it. But then I think it's really important when we're doing gardening to really model our own comfortability with it. And, like, you know, the first thing I always do when we're, like, dealing with sifting compost or anything is grabbing a handful of it and, like, smelling it and showing them how much I love the smell of it and sort of offering them to smell it. And then before you know it, someone else has grabbed a handful of it. So it's just, like, getting your own hands in there, being playful with, like, showing them your dirt under your fingernails as their souvenir for being there. Like, you just want to make it fun. But also, if a student doesn't want to put their hands in and doesn't want to touch a worm, like, maybe you hold the worm and they just touch it with their finger or whatever it is. So I think it's both, like, just modeling, getting in there, And they do that for each other as soon as one student does it, but allowing for there to be, you know, students who just don't want to do that, and that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I'm having flashbacks to when we were growing up and mom would be gardening, you know, on the weekends, let's say. And I don't think I wanted to garden with her. And I think I've talked to a few different adults who grow food now, who had no interest. You know, my coworker who's the school garden manager at school, for example, had no interest growing up and now wants to do it all the time. I'm curious to actually ask Shauna and Attila, do they have to pull teeth? Do you guys have to pull teeth to get your kids, you know, with their hands in the dirt, learning and or actually doing work that is actually helpful? And just, is it easier when kids are growing up in an area with production farms all around them to spark the interest? Or is it actually maybe even harder because maybe they take it for granted, and so they don't see it as like an area of information they need to dig into again, pardon my pun.
Yeah, well, we don't really push our kids to do farm chores as like something they have to do. And maybe we should push them more, but I feel like once they're out there on the farm, they could do stuff for hours, whether or not it's actually productive might be another discussion, but you know, they'll go out, and I always joke that in the summer I kind of don't feed them for a few hours and then I take them out to the farm so they can just completely graze on everything, and then I bring them inside and give them like a sausage, and then that's like a complete meal. So the farm is definitely a very ingrained part of their life, but I have never wanted it to be something they had to do. If they choose it, they choose it, but we've never made farming chores a thing, aside from kind of helping with animals or
cleaning eggs. Is
cleaning
good.
Eggs is a weekly thing we all do, yeah. But yeah.
And I guess then the follow-up question, if that's your approach to immersing your kids in the avocation that you both have chosen, is do you want them to fall to do that one day? I mean, you know, to the Wendell Berry point, I guess, do you hope that they are part of the generation of young farmers, or are you just not even thinking that way yet?
We're very much like, they're gonna do what they're gonna do. They're exposed to farming every single day. They'll know the reality of it if they want to do it and they choose it, but we're not like, we're going to pass you down the family farm. Like, yeah, we right. just, yeah, we're not doing that.
So one other quote from Wendell Berry, just because I it was such a rich interview with him, was he said, quote, "A passion for farming can grow only from an understanding of the intelligence and the learning involved in the right kind of farming. And we should add an understanding of the better cultures of husbandry and of the traditional agrarian values. That smart people are too smart to farm is one of the set of cliches by which industrial agriculture has maintained itself. Another is that farming is drudgery or mind-numbing work." So, Shauna, Attila, Dana, help him prove that cliche wrong. What are some parts of farming that are intellectual, super, you know, that really require intelligence and require you to continue as learners?
Yeah, I think what Shauna said earlier about being a generalist, maybe even, I feel like Wendell Berry uses that term too, but mechanics, fixing broken things, soil science, understanding biology and insects, ecology, there's so much of it, you know, whether it's science or there's an artistic side for a lot of people. I feel like the intellectual side of it is kind of endless, and maybe a reflection of each individual farmer, which direction they want to go. I know I heard your podcast with Heinz. You know, in our area, there's lots of examples of farmers that you might say are probably the smartest people that you've talked to, you know.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I agree. Chip and Susan Plank, and I mean, a lot of the smartest people we know are farmers.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do think, I mean, how you approach your work is going to dictate, you know, your success and how far you go with it. So I think if, you know, we find that with our employees too, like if they feel like farming is drudgery or if they're not wanting to come to work, then maybe it's not the job for them. But a lot of people like us kind of feel like it's more like sacrament almost, like it's kind of a, it's a, almost like spiritual occupation, you know? So yeah, but I do think you have to be doing it a certain way to feel like that.
Dana, what about you?
I think for me, it's really been that it's a job where I just feel like I'm constantly learning. And both, I mean, I think that, I think it was Attila who said it earlier, but about like just training yourself to be really observant. And I feel like living in a city, there are ways that I get to do that in my job and learn about the place of New York that I live in that I wouldn't if I wasn't engaging with the land every day. And that's something that, or some, you know, an area that I feel like I'm always learning. And also just existing as an urban grower and an urban gardener, I get to, you know, I get to be involved with a whole movement around food sovereignty and food justice and anti-oppression in our food system, all these things, and, you know, sort of like youth development programs and all these other sort of social aspects that get brought into an urban farm that also get brought into many rural farms, but are, you know, central to urban farming and growing in cities, that I feel like I'm just constantly learning sort of all these different ways in which, you know, having a green space in a city, growing food in a city, what that means, and why it's radical. And it's just a lot of learning around things like that for me.
I love that, Dana. Why it's radical. Just, it's true. You are radical, sister. So before we get to your official action items, as all three of you know that I will be asking you, I just want to take a moment to see if you can make one or two recommendations to listeners. I've actually already had a bunch, so we don't need to talk too much, but Dana, you too, of the best, you know, food growing education places to go, you know, if there's like a particular certification, which I don't think you're going to recommend, but maybe there's a course or a certification that listeners could look for either in the DC market, Virginia market, New York City market, or, you know, nationally.
Yeah, in our area, there's Future Harvest CASA. Mm-hmm. It's a strong organization. So you could go to their website and glean a lot. They have a calendar of all kinds of on-farm events. And they actually have this beginning farmer training program that's utilized by if people that aren't really ready to quit your day job, but maybe you can have time to do one day a month or one day a week. They have some these levels of that program that is worth looking into.
Yeah, and I would also say if you want to just expose your family or your kids, there's Woofing, like willing workers on organic farms, or even Workaway that has a lot of farm stays or farm education opportunities.
Is Woofing, like, has it grown even beyond what it used to be? I mean, Woofing as a, I guess it's an organization, has been around for decades. Do you think that it's evolved? Is it still like the number one way to find a farm internationally to work on?
I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think certain places, you know, certain countries, it's more developed than others.
Sure.
I guess it would depend on where you wanted to go.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. Dana, what about you?
So I would say one thing that comes to mind for New York City residents is that there is a program through Farm School NYC that I've never participated in the full program, but I've taken a class and it was amazing. But they offer sort of one-off classes for people that are interested, and also sort of a more full-blown urban farming certificate program where you work a full season on an urban farm in my neighborhood, Crown Heights, called Youth Farm. And at the same time, you're taking classes and doing farm visits and having discussions. So it's a very sort of very comprehensive program for within a city. But for me, and what I tell people who are interested in farming and didn't grow up around farms, didn't grow up with a family that farmed, I think it's, you just have to do it to see what it really looks like and feels like. And especially, you know, living in New York City, if that means working on an urban farm, you just have to take those seasonal positions that living in a city feels sort of scarier to take, I think, almost, because not many people around you are taking seasonal positions within the city. But I really just think that's the only way to be, you know, fully immersed in learning and doing it. So, yeah.
And I'll just chime in for those listeners who are in D.C. proper. I think rooting D.C. is a great first exposure to 100 organizations. And that's a conference that happens every spring at Woodrow Wilson High School. So I recommend that. In one day, you can learn all kinds of things. I just learned about an awesome organization called Cultivate the City that has 20 locations around DC. And I got to meet the founder, Neeraj Ray, and his mantra is grow your own food. And his whole approach is, you know, his garden center doesn't sell gardenias and marigolds. It sells unique varietals with unusual stories behind them. And I just think that he's a wonderful teacher, I can tell, and he leads a lot of classes that you can go and learn about propagation and different techniques to get your own plots going in D.C. or nearby. And finally, there's a great newsletter called The Doug Network, I think. It's written by a guy named Josh Singer. So if you're in D.C. and you want to be exposed to all of the courses in agriculture that are offered in this area, I recommend just a quick Google of Doug Network, D-U-G Network, and you'll be able to subscribe to the emails and you'll get them about once or twice a month. And it's a really exhaustive database. And then, you know, going back, Attila, I just want to say, he mentioned earlier ATRA.org, ATTRA.org, and Good Food Jobs as well. So action item time. Who would like to kick off offering one thing that listeners can do to improve our food system in whatever way you want to define improving our food system? Doesn't have to do anything with farming.
I can go first. I feel like mine is, I'm sad mine isn't more creative. So I'll go first, so I don't have to be the last one.
All right, with that great build up, what do you got?
Well, I think I was hoping to come up with something that was different. And then ever since the UN new report came out, I just can't stop thinking about climate chaos and all these things. And so mine is just, again, for the 1 millionth time you've heard it, to eat less meat. Not that you have to not eat meat, but to eat less meat.
Okay. I thought you were going to say to compost. Because I remember the course you took in college about just how much methane gas, I guess, is released by food decaying. Am I right? And that how much ozone could be recuperated if everyone composted. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't know about recuperated, but definitely. I would add definitely compost. But yeah, I could only choose one.
Eat less meat. Okay, thanks, Dana. No disclaimer needed next time. That's a great one, and I don't even think a Lunch Agenda guest has offered it yet. Okay, Shana or Attila?
Grow a plant. If you're able to come out to any of the markets in D.C. in the springtime, you know, April, May, a lot of the veggie farmers are actually selling plant starts, and you can pick up a couple easy to grow plants for a couple bucks and sort of see it for yourself. And it's, we really love selling plants and engaging in that, the conversation week to week. Like, somebody will come back and, like, you know, this, they'll have a picture on their phone, like, what's wrong with this leaf? You know, it's usually either too much water or not enough. So it's fun to to do it yourself. You know, even just one plant, one basil plant.
Yeah, we didn't even talk about that today. The fact that at that time of year, you guys are absolutely food growing teachers. You are, you're like unpaid growing coaches for all of the people who visit you at the market.
Yeah, really, we love it. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for that.
I feel like mine's not that creative either, but it's just cut out the middleman. So any way you can buy direct from a local farmer, and by cutting out the middleman, you just support that economy directly. You also probably cut out a lot of shipping, packaging, and there's a lot that happens when you just buy local and direct.
So I love it. We have a trifecta of changing what we eat, changing if we're growing, and changing how we're buying. Thank you. Cut out the middleman. So that was Shauna, Attila, and Dana that we're talking about how they have taught food growing, and I hope will continue to for a long time. You can follow them online, even though I will say, you know, of all my guests, those who have their hands in the dirt are less likely to have their hands on keyboards and phones posting all the time. But when they get a chance to, Dana's on Instagram at Diglett, D-I-G-G-L-E-T-T. Shauna and Attila are at Mountain V Farm. And their website, by the way, is mvf-organics.com. So I have to say, even though I talk to my sister, I could always talk to her more because I love her so much. But even though I talk to her so regularly, I learned things from her today, such as showing off the dirt under my fingernails if I'm teaching gardening to the kids at school, and holding that compost in my hand to show that I love the smell. Those little things that help us teach those around us the habits that we're hoping others will adopt. It was so great to learn, and I'm inspired to get deeper into my own food growing from this conversation. So thank you, Attila. Thank you, Shauna. Thank you, Dana. And next week, for all of you Lunch Agenda listeners, we'll be closing up this Teaching Food series. I'm really excited to announce that the interview will be with the New York Times food writer Mark Bittman. Through his 20 books and countless columns and lectures, he's known for a trademark voice about getting people comfortable in the kitchen. So tune in next week to hear how he thinks about teaching home cooks. Thanks again for joining Lunch Agenda's Teaching Food series, and I'll talk to you soon. Have a great day, everybody.